just filibusters, talks, you know, asks other people and misdirects. And it's really disappointing. But again, it's more evidence that Donald Trump doesn't actually have the intellectual capacity, the political sophistication, or the moral competence to be president of anything.
I want to go back to ABC News, Rachel Scott asking Trump a question.
Mr. President, I would love to ask you about January 6th. You've called yourself the candidate of law and order. Yeah. When Time magazine asked you if you would consider pardoning all the rioters, you said, yes, absolutely. Sure. You called them patriots. 140 police officers were assaulted that day. Their injuries included broken bones, at least one officer lost an eye, one had two cracked ribs, two smashed spinal discs, another had a stroke. Were the people who assaulted those 140 officers, including those I just mentioned, patriots who deserve pardons?
Well, let me bring it back to modern day. Like about 5 days ago, we had an attack on the Capitol, a horrible attack on the Capitol. You saw the people that were protesting and spraying these incredible monuments, bells, lions, all these magnificent limestone and granite with red paint, red spray paint that will never actually come off, especially on the limestone. It will never, I'm a builder, I know about this stuff. It'll never, you'll see it in 100 years from now. They viciously attacked our government. They fought with police. They fought with them much more openly than I saw on January 6th. What's going to happen to those people? What's going to happen to the people in Portland that destroyed
that city?
But, sir,
my question is on those.
What's going to happen to the people that tried to
bring rioters who assaulted officers?
You have to ask,
would you pardon
what's
those gonna people?
Happen? Oh, absolutely, I would.
You would pardon those.
If they're innocent, I would pardon them.
They've been convicted.
And by the way,
Mark Montel.
He's a fascinating person. First of all, if they're innocent, I'll pardon them is the most ridiculous thing. If they're innocent, they don't need a pardon, right? But what she was asking very clearly is, how do you reconcile calling these people patriots, these people who are protesting, but they're not just protesting, they're destroying the Capitol, they're raising an insurrection, they're trying to overtake a democratic institution, ostensibly. How do you justify calling them patriots and wanting to give them pardons? He couldn't answer it. So again, as Donald Trump does, and like most people with sort of toddler levels of political maturity do, he redirected and he said, let's go to recent history 5 days ago. And he starts talking about people who are protesting a genocide. He talks about people who are challenging American imperialism. And he tries to equate the two. And even then, he doesn't offer any kind of reasonable analysis. So that's two things that we have to think about. One, Donald Trump refuses to hold accountable the white supremacists and the insurrectionists and all the other people who are waging war against the vulnerable in this country and who have done so in demonstrable fashion. Even people like Donald Trump who call themselves law and order presidents, people who defend the blue no matter what. He even has created space to basically indemnify the people who harm the police who he worships. But then when someone is standing up against a genocidal war, when someone is not waging war on the Capitol, he called it an attack on the Capitol. Protesting in D.C. is not an attack on the Capitol. Donald Trump would probably call the March on Washington a vicious assault on our nation's home, right? Because he sees anybody who's black or brown or standing in solidarity with oppressed people as an enemy to the state. And in an imperialist state, he's not all the way wrong. But that's exactly why we can't have someone like Donald Trump as the steward of this empire.
So you mentioned pro-Palestinian protests. Kamala Harris is expected to announce her choice for running mate any day now, by Tuesday, it said. Potential candidates include Arizona Senator Mark Kelly, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, and Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro is reportedly at the top of her list. Many progressives are raising alarm about Shapiro's record on promoting corporate tax breaks and school vouchers, raising issues about accelerating climate change and demonizing pro-Palestinian protests. Earlier this year, Governor Shapiro called on the University of Pennsylvania to disband a Gaza solidarity encampment. He also supported the dismissal of the University of Pennsylvania's president, Elizabeth McGill, amidst that firestorm fueled by right-wing politicians and media over free speech and support for Palestinian rights on campus. This is Governor Shapiro speaking in May.
By their own admission, the leaders at the University of Pennsylvania have made clear that those protesters, those who are living in these so-called encampments, are violating the rules of the university and in some cases the laws of the city of Philadelphia. The university has tried to negotiate and discuss the matter with those protesters. That has proven to not be effective. Over the last 24 hours at the University of Pennsylvania, the situation has gotten even more unstable and out of control. More rules have been violated. More laws have been broken. That is absolutely unacceptable.
That's Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro speaking in the rain in May. Mark Lamont Hill, you're joining us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You're co-author of Except for Palestine, The Limits of Progressive Politics. You've covered these protests extensively, as well as the Middle East, as a host on Al Jazeera. Your response?
There are so many things here. There's a really good chance that Kamala Harris is going to choose Josh Shapiro to be her running mate. In the most obvious way, I oppose that. Josh Shapiro challenges democratic practices. He doesn't believe in free speech. He's warned, state employees here in Pennsylvania about how they respond to the genocide in Gaza, questioning their behavior, policing their behavior. He very clearly supports Zionism, political Zionism. He very clearly supports the genocidal war in Gaza. He's been actively and vocally supportive of Israel's war on Gaza since October 7th and prior. We could also get into school vouchers. We could get into climate justice. In every conceivable way, Josh Shapiro is not a progressive candidate. And it would be very frustrating to see her make that choice. But in some ways, it would make our political reality much more clear. People right now are trying to project a green screen onto Kamala Harris, the same way they did to Barack Obama, meaning they want to project their radical ideologies and their progressive ideologies and imagination onto her. That's not who she is. She very clearly supports AIPAC. She very clearly is a liberal, but certainly not a progressive or a radical. So what Josh Shapiro as a choice would do is it would remind us of what we're dealing with. If you're voting for Kamala Harris, it's not because you're getting a radical or even a progressive. You're voting for her because you want to keep Trump out of the White House. You can make your own political decisions about what that means, but we need to be very clear about what we're getting and about what we're not getting. But if you were somebody who was not voting for Biden because of him underwriting this vicious war in Gaza, then there's absolutely no way you could justify voting for Kamala Harris as she chooses Josh Shapiro. And the two of them, it's not just Shapiro, the two of them are just as supportive of this war machine as every other mainstream corporate Democrat.
And to those who say, to your response, that you can vote for Kamala Harris if you want to keep Trump out of the White House, that Governor Shapiro, presides over a state that is a key battleground state that she would need to win.
Well, that's the argument, right? Is that it's Trump's argument for choosing J.D. Vance, which he probably regrets at this point. If you want to keep Trump out of the White House, Josh Shapiro does help. I mean, that's a great point. But the question is, when you win the White House, what do you get, right? There has to be a way to keep Trump away, to keep Trump out of D.C., which I support, but still not compromise all possibility of actually meeting our collective needs. Again, I'm not talking about pie in the sky. I'm not talking about an imagined future 100 years from now. I'm saying right now, we have to challenge Kamala Harris to be better. We have to challenge Kamala Harris to meet our needs. And if we don't even hold her accountable for the vice presidential choices she makes right now, when there are clearly more progressive options on the table, then we've forfeited our own kind of agency here. Let's do both. Let's keep Trump out of the White House, but let's also apply some pressure. That's all I got to say.
Mark Lamont Hill, I want to thank you very much for being with us, member of the National Association of Black Journalists, host of Upfront on Al Jazeera English, and a nightly YouTube show called Night School, also professor of anthropology and urban education at the City University of New York Graduate Center, speaking to us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Next up, an historic prisoner swap. We'll look at the negotiations that led to the freeing of Americans, Russian human rights activists, and others jailed in Russia. We'll speak with Katrina Vandenhoevel, Russia expert and publisher of The Nation magazine. Back in 30 seconds. Go by Chappelle Roan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We're spending the rest of the hour looking at the largest prisoner exchange between Russia and the West since the Cold War. Included in the swap are Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, former Marine Paul Whelan, and Russian-American journalist Alsu Karmasheva, who landed in the United States late Thursday night after being freed from Russian custody. It was just about midnight when President Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris greeted them at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland as their family members rushed to embrace them. Biden spoke earlier in the day, surrounded by the released prisoners' relatives.
Today, we're bringing home Paul, Evan, Alsu, Vladimir. Three American citizens, one American green card holder. All four have been imprisoned unjustly in Russia. Russian authorities arrested them, convicted them in show trials, and sentenced them to long prison terms with absolutely no legitimate reason whatsoever. And now their brutal ordeal is over. This deal would not have been made possible without our allies. Germany, Poland, Slovenia, Norway, and Turkey, they all stepped up and they stood with us. They stood with us, and they made bold and brave decisions, released prisoners being held in their countries who are justifiably being held, and provided logistical support to get the Americans home. So for anyone who questions whether allies matter, they do. They matter.
Russian-British dissident Vladimir Karamurza, who has a U.S. green card, was also released in the swap, but was not on the U.S. flight with Gershkovich, Whelan, and Karmasheva. This comes just weeks after a Russian court convicted Evan Gershkovich of espionage, sentencing him to 16 years in prison, a move denounced by press freedom groups. Paul Whelan was sentenced to 16 years in prison in 2020 on spying charges, which he denied. In total, 16 political prisoners, Russian human rights activists, journalists, and others were freed by Russia in the exchange. Five were German nationals, seven Russian, including human rights defender Oleg Orlov, who served as a leading member of Memorial, one of the oldest human rights organizations in Russia. Memorial, which has been outlawed by Putin, was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2022. Some of the freed activists had links with Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny, among them Ksenia Fadieva, who was the head of Navalny's office in Tomsk, a university town in Siberia. In return, eight Russians were released from prisons in the U.S., Germany, Norway, Slovenia, and Poland, including Vadim Krasikov, a convicted Russian assassin who was in German custody after the 2019 killing of a Chechen dissident in Berlin in broad daylight. Thursday's massive exchange came after about 2 years of complicated negotiations with the U.S., Russia, and other European countries, including Belarus and Germany, which ultimately agreed to Moscow's key demand to free Krasikov. The U.S. had pushed to include Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny in the swap before his death in an Arctic prison in February. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan addressed this in a press briefing yesterday.
We had been working with our partners on a deal that would have included Alexei Navalny, and unfortunately, he died. In fact, on the very day that he died, I saw Evan's parents, and I told them that the president was determined to get this done, even in light of that tragic news, and that we were going to work day and night to get to this day. And so that work continued over the course of the past few months and culminated in today.
Alexei Navalny's closest ally, Leonid Volkov, said on social media, "Today we're reveling in the release of political prisoners, Putin's hostages who are suffering in Putin's gulag, but it still will be joy with tears in our eyes. The Navalny swap has taken place, but without Navalny, it hurts a lot," he said. For more, we're joined here in New York by Katrina Vandenhoevel, Russia expert, publisher of The Nation magazine. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Katrina. If you can talk about the significance of the swap and who was released on both sides.
Well, it's an extraordinary swap, as you know, Amy, the complexity of it. It reminds of the Cold War, but it is more complex in many ways. I think what was so stunning, of course, the human drama, the human pain that is relieved, but the fact that there have been masterful negotiations behind the scenes, the back-channel diplomacy that had to occur to make this day happen. And we so often hear of working with allies to pass on weapons or to fight wars. But in this case, it was to start a dialogue, to bring out the political prisoners, the others. And I think that is hopeful that we're going to see maybe more of a pathway to dialogue toward ending the war. But I also think that what's interesting is the politics of it. Kamala Harris, the vice president, clearly played a role in an important moment. Bilateral talks with the German leader, Olaf Scholz, to release Krasikov. And Krasikov, as you mentioned, Amy, was the pivot for Putin. And he has been called an assassin. And he did, it's Putin's loyalty to such people in order to continue recruiting for extrajudicial actions. But Krasikov is convicted of killing a Chechen terrorist, Chechen war fighter. And for Putin, the Chechen war remains this stain that he continues to try to exercise. We saw with Tajikistan and the terrorist acts just a few months ago. But I'd come away primarily listening to a Jake Sullivan who broke down from maybe the stress of the last 2 years. To keep this quiet has always been key for back-channel diplomacy. When I was in Moscow in 1986, Amy, there was the picking up of Nick Daniloff of U.S. News and World Report. He was in prison for only 15 days, and he was exchanged. So we've seen these kinds of exchanges going way back. But the complexity of this one and what it may mean is very important.
And if you can talk about, I mean, Evan Gershkovich, now everyone has heard his name, the Wall Street Journal reporter. And apparently, when he had to sign documents at the end when he was being released, he wrote that he wanted to interview Russian President Putin.
I'm not allowed to say a bad word, but I would say real courage and temerity. But he's from a Russian emigre family, and he grew up in New Jersey, but his mother, who he lifted off the tarmac, was so fearful because she remembered what Lefortovo, that is the prison Evan Gershkovich was in for too long, what that meant in the Stalin years. People didn't come out. But fortunately, Evan Gershkovich is here. May he get the interview with Putin. And may I point out that Mr. Trump has all along been belligerently aggressive about how only would Putin give the hostages to him, Trump. He could do it in a day. Well, it turns out, and this is commentary inside Moscow, that maybe the Putin administration regime prefers Harris's more steadfast policies. They're kind of sick of this Trump lack of discipline, to be kind. So I found that, I think, and Russian observers have found that interesting. I will say that there are others, Vladimir Kara-Murza, whose father was a major television personality inside the Soviet Union. He is, as you know, Amy, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post, a fierce oppositionist figure, and I think it demands quite a bit. Of course he should be released. He should never have been in prison. But to release him to the West is, of course, to empower him in his oppositionist activities and continuing to write, as he has, against the Putin regime. The sadness of Navalny. I have to say, there was a similar case, Amy. Your listeners may remember Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the oligarch who was imprisoned for too long. He was released around the time he took up a hunger strike, I believe. Kremlin wanted him to leave. And I think with Navalny, who received almost 30% in his run for Moscow's mayor in 2013, he returned to his home country. But I'm not sure that the commentary, which quickly impugns Putin for killing him, now bringing him to that Arctic prison, is part of a death sentence, perhaps. But there was real action. and I heard this from independent Russians close to the scene, to release Navalny. And we now hear how that was in play.
And it's very interesting that the U.S. negotiated with other Western countries the release of Russian human rights activists, not Russian-American. Absolutely. If you can talk about the significance of that, like the head of Memorial.
Well, of course, Mr. Orlov, who's 71, had left the country and then came back. And I think there's an understanding of the dissidents and the role dissidents play and the need to save and protect them. I will say, Mr. Orlov, and there were several people who were involved with Navalny's organization, the Anti-Corruption Unit. So I think that was a sign of, it's not the Navalny swap, but it has elements of it. I will say that there are still political prisoners in Russia. And Boris Kagarlitsky, who has been on your program, Amy, is someone who has been arrested and convicted for 6.5 years for simple opposition to the war in Ukraine. Lula and other international leaders have signed a letter of protest in solidarity. And if you go to thenation.com and put in Boris Kagarlitsky, you can see what you can do to assist in release, not just of Boris, but there are others who are part of his Institute for Labor and Social Movements.
Christian Mier, the Deputy General Secretary of Amnesty International in Germany, said the prisoner exchange left a bitter taste. In a statement, the group warned Russian President Putin, quote, is clearly instrumentalizing the law and order to use political prisoners as pawns, and said that on one side there were, quote, a murderer and other criminals who have been convicted in a fair trial, and on the other, people who have just exercised their right to free speech. The prisoner exchange is therefore a step towards broadening impunity, Mier said. If you can respond to that and also talk about the other Russians who were released to Russia, in addition to this assassin of the Chechen in broad daylight in Berlin.
Well, let me just begin with that, if I might, Amy. There was a couple who I believe lived in South America, and they— their children were traveling with them to Moscow. They didn't speak, the children didn't speak Russian and didn't know their parents were Russians. This is sort of like the Americans, but I mean, you have low-level spies, you have low-level hucksters, scammers. The most serious criminal is Krasikov assassination. So the others were more kind of plain, ordinary. But I do think this issue of hostage, of impugning those who undertake hostage negotiations. Amy, there's a history. You know, Jesse Jackson taking soldiers out of Syria, Bill Richardson, the back channel around the Cuban Five. I think that better than to war is to have these negotiations, masterful diplomacy, as President Biden and others have said, that do not bring about moral equivalency, but do bring about release of those loved ones. And no one exchanged money. There's no transaction. And I think we're sturdy enough and steady enough and resilient enough as a country to understand that hostage release is not transactional, and also that negotiations and diplomacy are not about capitulation. They're about improving the conditions of a world which is too militarized and at war. So I do think in the mix of people, and there have been, I think, there are 16 on the U.S. side. And think about the negotiations that had to occur with the other countries. That is a measure of collaboration that I think does merit the word allies doing the right thing.
And that's exactly the point that Biden made yesterday, clearly making a reference to Trump, saying this took allies, especially the German chancellor, agreeing to release the assassin. That took allies and not alienating allies. But I wanted to go, as you talk about war, to the issue of the Ukraine war. Do you think that this prisoner swap, the agreement at the highest levels of the United States, Germany, Russia, with Putin, could lead to some kind of negotiation to the end of the war in Ukraine?
I do, Amy. As I referred at the top, I do think it offers a possible pathway. And the timing is such that Ukraine, it's the polling, independent Ukrainian polling is showing that more and more Ukrainians can contemplate a negotiated into this war. Of course, there are questions about ceding land and other things, but Ukraine is war weary, as is Russia. And the men being mobilized, the draft age is now 60. In both countries, they're conscripting prisoners. I think Zelensky, in an interview with the Philadelphia Inquirer about a week ago, spoke of the possibility of negotiations. I think the security for Ukraine can be negotiated apart from NATO, the issue which has so roiled the situation. But I think the time has come. Ukraine is a third of its size. It has very few men remaining, very little materiel, and the money, the World Bank estimates reconstruction of Ukraine at this moment could be about $1 trillion. So I think only diplomacy, a word that is often overused but is real, is the resolution to this cruel, horrific
and Katrina,
kind of war with 21st century weapons.
Katrina, what about the significance of the timing of this swap? They've been working on it, apparently, for several years, as you said. This is right before the Democratic Convention. You have the release of Americans. The whole
it's
issue
something that
of,
Reagan,
go ahead.
The Republicans often, remember Reagan and the hostage? How can we forget the Iranian hostage crisis? And we've learned more about how that was ginned up to support Reagan's record. But I do think the timing, and this has been commented on in Moscow, Amy, that the timing suggests that they're fed up with Trump. And I think that there's more interest in a more stable foreign policy, though there's also hope that Kamala Harris and her chief national security advisor, Philip Gordon, is less hawkish than a Victoria Nuland or those who have been too involved in the Ukraine situation. So I do think there's a timing element, and I do think Mr. Trump has been upended in the sense, and I do think the Russiagate stuff about how Putin put Trump in the White House is increasingly discredited, but that is the commentary inside Moscow.
And when it comes to the Ukraine war, Ukraine has received its first collection of F-16 combat jets after
but
a
Amy,
very
they're
long
training
wait.
The men are still being, I believe, mostly men. The women are in the army, but they're being trained, and it's a long process. And that soon will come another muddy, horrific winter made worse by Russia's bombing of the grid. And Russia should not be let off. I mean, there has to be some measure of even, I wouldn't use the word, but reparations in rebuilding Ukraine. But again, the war weariness is deep in both countries, though Russia is better equipped to handle a long war. People are not. Many people are so war weary.
So are you saying you think that Putin thinks he might work better with Katrina, he might work better with Kamala Harris than with Donald Trump?
I do. I think Russia does not like unhinged, unstable, undisciplined. And, you know, Mr. Trump has brought in people like John Bolton, who are eternal cold warriors. There's a new generation. I'm not sure Putin's part of it, but there is a new generation that for many, the Cold War is ancient history. And there needs to be a dialogue. And in fact, the defense secretary. So there needs to be an ongoing dialogue for security reasons, nuclear reasons. So this could be setting a pathway. For 2 years, there was dialogue. You're not going to just cut it off at the pass.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, Russia expert and publisher of The Nation magazine. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, are you a First Nations, Métis, or Inuit student? Not convinced university, college, or vocational trade school is possible? Or wondering what you should do after high school? Inspire can help you and your friends. Register for Inspire's free Indigenous mentorship program, Rivers to Success. Joining Rivers to Success gets you access to great information, great prizes, and exciting content. Discover careers and post-secondary paths geared towards Indigenous students across Turtle Island, just like you. Register online today at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca. Prizes, information, and fun are waiting.
You're listening to CGSF.